the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network presents Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis. Each week, Joan brings you news from inside the Vatican and the Church around the world, as well as interviews and answers to your questions. Now, here's the host of Vatican Insider, Joan Lewis.
Welcome to Vatican Insider on this Easter weekend. A special weekend deserves a special Vatican Insider, and I have just that for you. After the news, stay tuned for part two of the special I've prepared, where I try to answer the question, who is the man of the shroud? Now for decades, as worshipers gather around the world to commemorate Christ's passion, death, and resurrection, scientists have been studying the results of tests made on an object alleged to be directly connected with that passion. The object of intense religious devotion, as well as scientific curiosity, is a simple strip of linen known as the Shroud of Turin. I explore the provenance and history of that relic, as well as the scientific tests that have been done over the years in order to find an answer to the question, who is the man of the shroud? This is an abbreviated Vatican Insider, as EWTN employees have Holy Thursday and Good Friday off to participate in Holy Week liturgies. The news summary ends with Wednesday's events. Sunday, March 24th, Palm Sunday. On Palm Sunday, of course, we officially entered Holy Week, a period that is both joyful and somber, filled with liturgies that bring us from the Last Supper and institution of the priesthood and the Eucharist to Christ's passion and death on the cross to his resurrection. Palm Sunday celebrations are always evocative, wherever celebrated, but perhaps no more so than at the Vatican, where, in a sun-splashed, majestic St. Peter's Square, more than 30 cardinals wearing red vestments, 25 bishops, and 350 priests processed around the square and up to the altar level bearing palmarelli, tall, intricately woven palm branches. They were joined by hundreds of faithful carrying palm and olive branches. Given his ongoing mobility issues, Pope Francis was already seated in front of the altar at the start of Mass. He read an opening prayer in a weak voice, and breathing issues were notable through the microphone. Remarkably, for the first time in memory of those covering a public festive papal Mass, the Pope did not deliver a homily. No aide delivered it in his stead, and no reason was ever given by the press office. Several minutes of silence prevailed instead. Francis did stand briefly for the final blessing and then seated again, prayed the Angelus with the faithful sounding a bit stronger. He said, "I assure my prayers for the victims of the vile terrorist attack carried out the other evening in Moscow in a concert hall. May the Lord convert the hearts of those who plan, organize, and carry out such inhuman actions, which offend God, who commanded, 'Thou shalt not kill.'" The Holy Father also highlighted martyred Ukraine, saying so many people are without electricity due to intense attacks against infrastructure, which, besides causing death and suffering, raise the risk of an even greater humanitarian catastrophe. "Let us also think of Gaza," he said, "which is suffering greatly along with other places of war." After Mass, Pope Francis boarded the white papal jeep, and he circled St. Peter's Square for more than 15 minutes. Monday, March 25th. In the morning, Pope Francis received Rome's Nigerian community in audience. He expressed his gratitude for their joyful witness to the gospel, as well as, quote, "the numerous young people from Nigeria who have heard the Lord's call to the priesthood and the consecrated life, responding with generosity, humility, and perseverance." The Pope said, "The diversity of ethnicities, cultural traditions, and languages in your nation is not a problem, but a gift." Also Monday, in a message released on the fifth anniversary of the apostolic exhortation Christus Vivit, written after the 2018 Synod on Young People, Pope Francis invited youth to make their voice heard as they bear witness before everyone to the joy born of friendship with Christ. Above all, he said, "I would like my words to be a source of renewed hope for young people who may feel discouraged in a world marked by so many conflicts and so much suffering. Christ is alive, and he loves you with an infinite love. Walk with him as a friend. Welcome him into your life, and let him share all the joys and hopes, the problems and struggles of this time of your life. Tuesday, March 26th. In a video message addressed to the community of Rosario, Argentina, Pope Francis expressed his concern over the increase in drug-related violence that has gripped the Argentinian city for over a decade. Rosario, the nation's third-largest city, is facing an unprecedented increase in drug-related criminal violence. Also Tuesday, the Vatican announced that Pope Francis is personally writing the meditations for the iconic Way of the Cross to be celebrated Good Friday evening at the Colosseum. In prayer with Jesus on the Way of the Cross, this is the theme of the reflections that will accompany the 14 stations at the Colosseum. Wednesday, March 27th, Pope Francis presided at the weekly general audience that was moved from St. Peter's Square to the Paul VI Hall due to rain. He continued the catechesis on the virtues, turning to patience, saying it has its supreme model in the example of Jesus during his passion. The patience of Jesus did not consist in a stoic endurance of suffering, but was the fruit of his love. This Holy Week, said Francis, let us ask the grace of the Holy Spirit to imitate Christ in his patience and in his compassionate love, which forgives all wrongs and shows mercy even to his enemies. The Pope also greeted and met with two fathers, a Palestinian and an Israeli, both of whom lost their daughters, ages 10 and 13, in recent years because of the war in the Holy Land. Finding friendship and solace in sharing the greatest pain possible for a parent, they now work together to promote peace and justice through the association, the Parents' Circle. Also Wednesday, in an Easter letter addressed to Catholics in the Holy Land, Pope Francis expressed his spiritual closeness and paternal affection, and he encouraged Christians around the world to offer concrete support and prayers for peace. I embrace all of you in the variety of your rites, dear Catholic faithful, living throughout the Holy Land. In a particular way, I embrace those most affected by the senseless tragedy of war, the children robbed of their future, those who grieve and are in pain, and all who find themselves prey to anguish and dismay. Well, those are the news highlights, but now stay here for my special on the Man of the Shroud, wishing you and yours a beautiful and blessed Easter of the Resurrection.
This is Father Timothy Gallagher, an oblate of the Virgin Mary. Catholic radio accompanies us in the car when we drive, when our hands are busy but our minds are free. It can fill those spaces and bring us close to the Lord and help us grow in the understanding of our faith and deepen our way of living that faith each day.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Carry the faith wherever you go. Catch up with the latest news from Washington, D.C., the Vatican, and the world on all of our EWTN news platforms, including EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, the Catholic News Agency, and EWTN News In Depth. Download the EWTN app at EWTNApps.com today. Welcome back to Vatican Insider. Here's Joan Lewis.
Welcome to part two of my account of the Shroud of Turin, believed to be the linen cloth that wrapped the body of the crucified Jesus during his 3 days in the tomb. Last weekend, I looked at its journey through time and history and mentioned just some of the many tests done on this cloth since Secondo Pia took his famous photograph in 1898, a photo whose negative of a negative became a remarkable positive and reopened the case for the authenticity of the Shroud. Now looking back in a moment in the history of the Shroud. In 1578, St. Charles Borromeo, Archbishop of Milan, expressed the desire to venerate the precious relic of Christianity, but because of frail health, could not cross the Alps from Italy for the arduous trip because, of course, at the time it was in France. The Duke of Savoy, Emmanuel Filiberto, shortened the Archbishop's trip by bringing the shroud to Turin in May of that year. It has been in Turin for the past 437 years, except for the brief periods when it was removed to protect it from the dangers of war. For years, the shroud was wrapped widthwise around a wooden spool and housed in a silver reliquary above the main altar of an exceptionally beautiful chapel of black and gray marble designed by the Baroque architect Guarino Guarini. The chapel, especially designed for the shroud, is next to the Cathedral of St. John and is a masterpiece of architectural daring with an extraordinary dome of interlacing arches culminating in a gilded sunburst. At present, the shroud is kept flat inside an aluminum and glass case at a constant temperature in an atmosphere of argon gas. It is covered by a drape, embroidered with words in Latin that mean, "We revere your holy shroud, O Lord, and through it we meditate on your passion." On numerous occasions since 1898, when Secondo Pia photographed the shroud, including the 1969 appointment of a Roman diocesan commission to study the linen, photographs using techniques vastly superior to those of 1898 have been taken all upon special appointment and with the permission of its then legal owners, the House of Savoy, and now the Holy See. With these constantly improved photographs, the studies of the shroud multiplied and intensified over the years, involving many nations and many men and women. In the early 20th century, Dr. Pierre Barbet, a Paris surgeon and forerunner of today's syndonologists, that is, experts on the shroud, completed tests on cadavers to parallel the findings with what he, quote, read in the life-sized photographs of the crucified man. Joining him were Paul Vignon, a French biologist, and Yves Delage, a member of the Academy of Science in Paris. Later, Giovanni Giudica Cordiglia, degreed in medicine at Turin and in law at Pavia, and a professor of legal medicine in Milan, devoted his life and talents to the study of the shroud in yet another effort to arrive at its authenticity. Modern scientific investigative techniques were also used by the late Max Frey, for years a criminologist with the scientific police in Zurich, Switzerland, by Ian Wilson, a graduate student of history at Oxford University, by Reverend Morris Green, British priest and historian, and Father Peter Rinaldi, a Turin-born priest who at one time was vice president of the 7,000-member Holy Shroud Guild in the United States. Now, these few names are only the tip of the proverbial iceberg when it comes to naming experts on the Shroud of Turin, but some of the earliest studies on the shroud have also been the most remarkable. Max Frey, the Swiss forensic expert, aided by photographic enlargements, studied the microsedimentations present on the fabric, and he identified pollens, indicating not only the shroud's likely provenance, but its itinerary in the years before it reached Turin. Over 30 specific pollens were named as belonging to plants in the Palestine area, Turkey, and Western Europe. Each plant, even now extinct ones, has its own specific pollen, distinguishable from all other plants and as individual as fingerprints. Frey's long voyages, arduous studies, and astounding results played a major role in lending credibility to the authenticity of the shroud. Ultraviolet photography was first used in 1969 by Giovanni Battista Giudica Cordiglia, the son of the famed professor of legal medicine. This method, frequently used by police and art experts, traces organic substances which, if present on a tissue and illuminated by a mercury lamp, emit fluorescences that show up on the special photographic plates. Ultraviolet photography aids in neutron activation analysis and the evaluation of the origin of fibers and organic substance on these fibers, and it was instrumental in Max Frey's incredible findings. American contributions have been significant over the years. Dr. Donald Lynn of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, used enhanced photograph and aided image techniques, similar to those employed when the American spaceship Viking sent photos back from Mars. With the aid of a scanner, the markings on the shroud were broken down into a series of microscopic dots, and these in turn were translated into a mathematical code. The codified dots were then fed into a computer whose multiple readings provided information on the composition of the fabric, organic substances on its surface, and last but not least in importance, an electronically enhanced image of the entire shroud. Now, the enhanced photograph technique in the case of the shroud gave a three-dimensional effect. Simply put, it's much like listening to a Beethoven symphony in stereo. Nothing new is added to the original music, but its value is now enhanced. With the shroud, the original images were reinforced. In the 1970s and 80s, Captains John Jackson, a physicist, and Eric Jumper of the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, used in their research both a microdensitometer and an image analyzer, the VP-8, which gave a third dimension, that of depth, to the photographs. Their process translated electronically the diverse light intensities of the photographs of the shroud into a third-dimensional image. Whereas normal photographs show light and shadow, theirs also showed depth, the distance of the shroud from various parts of the body, in an analysis of flat versus volume. These modern methods of photography and scientific laboratory analysis allowed the human eye to see what previously went unnoticed, and they confirmed beyond a doubt the authenticity of the shroud. Earlier accusations of a falsification by painting were destroyed, as, with painstaking slowness and precision, it was revealed that someone who wanted to forge this would have to have been erudite in modern photographic techniques in order to recreate the perfect negative image on the shroud. He would also have to have been skilled in medical sciences to have known about the process of blood plasma separation represented by the carmine color stains on the shroud. The late Monsignor Ricci, whom I mentioned last week as one of the foremost world's experts on the shroud, told me in our first conversation those many years ago that surgeons reconstructing what has been read in the many photographs confirmed the exactness of anatomical details. The state of rigor mortis is in perfect accord with the biblical description of Christ's crucifixion. Studies of the various blood flows revealed the crucified man to have been in positions both of relaxation and then of pulling himself up. Surgical experiments also revealed that if a body is nailed to a cross through the palm of the hand, the sheer weight of the body tears the flesh in a short time, thus offering no support. However, if a nail is placed through the wrist in the so-called desto space, the weight will be more easily borne for a longer period. In addition, the carpus area of the wrist contains the median nerve, a highly sensitive motor nerve, and if a nail is hammered into this nerve, it causes the thumb to bend inward toward the palm. This fact shows up on the hand imprints of the man on the shroud, where only four fingers are visible. Close study also revealed that the legs were slightly bent and that only one nail was used to pierce both feet, evidenced again by the flow of blood. This nail allowed the crucified man upward movement, and both wrist and feet wounds showed he was alternately in a position of relaxation and of upward movement, thus avoiding death by suffocation that would have occurred had he remained only in a hanging position. For years, the most debated point was the exact cause of death of the man of the shroud. The strong arguments against the death by suffocation seemed to offer, on the one hand, conclusive proofs for death by infarction and hemopericardium, that is, the breaking of the heart. Monsignor Ricci's intensive studies were based on a theory put forth in the mid-19th century by an English physician, William Stroud. Dr. Stroud's research was favored by the fact that autopsies could be performed in England as soon as 2 hours after death, whereas on the continent, there was a mandatory interim of 48 hours. Basing his studies on St. John's Bible passage, quote, "and immediately there came out blood and water," quote, referring to the soldier's lance piercing the side of Christ 2 hours after his death, Stroud proceeded to prove that had the heart been undamaged prior to death, the blood and water, the plasma, would have flowed out mixed together in a single liquid. Whereas, in a previously ruptured heart, the blood would already have separated into two elements, the red corpuscles and the plasma. Thus, the hypothesis, based on the biblical eyewitness accounts and supported by actual autopsies, of a ruptured heart. The intensive mental anguish of Gethsemane that caused Christ to sweat blood even before his ordeal, the extreme shock caused by multiple scourge marks, there were over 120 separate lashes deeply inflicted, and these can be counted by blood marks on the shroud. The pain and the loss of blood through flagellation and the crowning with the helmet of thorns all combined to cause heart failure. Christ's loud cry at the moment of death, utterly impossible in the case of suffocation, announced the moment of rupture. Modern cardiology supports the theory that extreme moral stress can precondition the body for heart attacks and that, given even minor physical provocation, the heart will give in to this stress. While archaeologists, scientists, doctors, and theologians have probed, read, analyzed, and interpreted the shroud to determine its authenticity, artists have played their role in determining its provenance and suggesting the identity of the man in the shroud. In the first centuries after Christ, artistic representations of the cross depicted Christ as a fish. Its letters, spelled out in Greek, mean Jesus Christ, Son of God the Savior. They also depicted him as a lamb. The figure of Christ man on the cross was non-existent. Slowly, however, in the post-Constantine era, when Christians were allowed more freedom of expression, crosses appeared with a toned-down, fully clothed Christ. Curiously, the Byzantine art of the 4th to 11th centuries brought a coherence to the art of the cross, depicting a bearded Christ, half-nude, suffering and nailed to the cross, suggesting that the shroud had been exposed in the Eastern world in that period and that artists portrayed what they saw on the shroud. Contemporary art in the Western world, however, still showed Christ fully clothed and usually beardless, thus providing a strong argument for the historians who quote the shroud as first appearing in the West only after 1204. In the magical encounters between the ancient relic and men of science, art, and theology, the greatest mystery today lies in the question, how did the bodily imprints get onto the linen? Now, two theories are prevalent. Perhaps Monsignor Ricci, referring to these theories, best answered when he said, where research ends, faith begins. For researchers, the imprints could have been caused by the powdered aloes and myrrh spread on the shroud in a temporary effort at preservation of the body prior to full burial. For the Jews, the quickening approach of the Sabbath allowed only hasty pre-burial rites. These substances could have had a chemical reaction due to vapors or body liquids and the dampness of the tomb, thus causing the imprints to surface. On the other hand, they could have been caused by an inexplicable release of energy, a microsecond burst of radiation scorching the surface of the cloth. To date, there has been no scientific proof that would give credence to this second theory. Outstanding, however, were the findings of Baimabolone and Rodante that would confirm the first theory as being scientifically irrefutable. Their repeated experiments proved consistent in their results. If a fabric impregnated with aloes and myrrh and in direct contact with a body covered with coagulated bloodstains was exposed to conditions of humidity or moisture, there would appear in approximately 36 hours bodily imprints identical in nature to those of the shroud. In 1988, a carbon-14 dating test was performed on scraps of the shroud, an independent test in laboratories in Tucson, Arizona, Oxford, Great Britain, and Zurich, Switzerland. Test results said the shroud dated from 1260 to 1390, which of course would rule out it being used during the time of Christ. However, tests done since then by scientists at the University of Padua in northern Italy used the same fibers from the 1988 test but disputed the findings. The newer examinations date the shroud to between 300 BC and 400 AD, which would put it in the era of Christ. Brendan Whiting, author of the 2000 book, The Shroud Story, introduced the world to the most powerful evidence that the 1988 Shroud C14 dating test was invalid. Most recent tests have determined that the earlier carbon dating test results were likely skewed by contamination from fibers used to repair the cloth when it was damaged by fire in the Middle Ages. In addition, there would have been contamination from the hands of the nuns used to repair the cloth. Now, the Catholic Church has never pronounced itself officially on the authenticity of the shroud or the identity of the man. Nor is it, quote, within the Church's doctrinal definition to declare the authenticity of any relic. Importantly, the Church has never denied its authenticity. Several popes have openly expressed reverence for the shroud, and Pope Pius XI dedicated a prayer to it. In September 1936, he said, "There is still much mystery surrounding the sacred object, but it is certainly sacred as perhaps no other thing is sacred. And assuredly, one can say this as an acknowledged fact, even apart from all ideas of faith or Christian piety. It is certainly not a human work." Paul VI said, "Perhaps only the image of the shroud gives us something of the mystery of this human and divine figure." More recently, Pope Francis and his predecessor, Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, both described the Shroud of Turin as an icon, and St. John Paul called the shroud a mirror of the gospel. Hundreds of scholars from a variety of fields have spent hundreds of thousands of hours and millions of words researching and writing about the shroud. This could be a book-length account if it were to include mention of only a score of these scholars. The question remains, who is the man of the shroud? The answer has been almost unanimous since experiments done following Secondo Pia's photograph in 1898. Syndonologists, experts on the shroud, some even previously atheists, have paralleled their findings with the evangelical account of the death of Jesus, and they conclude that scientific, objective evidence proves the man to be Jesus. When asked if he believed the man of the shroud was Christ, Monsignor Ricci told me years ago there was perfect agreement between the gospel account of the death of Jesus and the story told by the shroud. He said, "If one had recourse to the gospel, the document of faith, and to a careful reading of the Holy Shroud, the archaeological document, you see that both speak of Christ with unmistakable certainty."
For more information on these stories, or to check out Joan's blog and to ask her a question, go to EWTN.com. That's EWTN.com. Thanks for listening to Vatican Insider on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.